Well, thank you all for being here. I'm very, very happy to be here myself with an old friend of mine and also an old friend of the Institute's, Anthony Bubalo. I'm sure many of you know him as a familiar face. He was the former deputy director of the Institute, and he's now a non-resident fellow. And I'm particularly pleased to have him here today because I think that there are very few people in Australia, in fact, I think globally, really, who have the same longstanding connections to the region, the insights into the dynamics of the Middle East. And let's face it, this is a region I think that many get wrong, misinterpret, or they probably resort to lazy stereotypes or inaccurate historical takes. But Anthony's not one of those people. Not many people appreciate its diversity and nuance, along with the challenges that the Middle East faces, as well as Anthony does. And it is very apparent in this new book, Remaking the Middle East by Anthony Bubalo. It's a Lowy Institute paper published as a Penguin book. And in this book, he puts forward a very accessible explanation of two things: what has driven and still drives, frankly, the unrest and instability in the Middle East. And then he also makes a very cogent argument about why democracy and good governance is not something alien to the region, as many actually have argued since the Arab uprisings and even before. And when I was preparing for this talk and this discussion, I came across an old essay that you wrote in response to an essay, a quarterly essay in 2004 during the Iraq War. And you counter the argument in there that the Iraqis can't democratize themselves. So I think there's always been this longstanding idea that the Arabs can't govern themselves, that the region cannot have good governance and democracy. So this isn't a new argument for Anthony. This is something that he's been talking about for a long time. And all of that's culminated here in this great book. And if you're a person who's new to the issues of the Middle East, this is a great foundational book. And if you're someone who has a longstanding interest in the region, it really gleans some great insights. So I'm really excited to get into the discussion today, but before I do, I want to properly introduce Anthony. Like I said, he's currently a non-resident fellow at the Lowy Institute. He's also a principal at Naus Consulting, where he focuses on defense and security with other things. And he's, of course, a founding member of the Institute, where he was the deputy director and research director. And he himself has also researched and written on a variety of Middle Eastern issues, including the links with Asia, Islamism, democratization, terrorism, and energy security. Anthony was also, in a past life, an officer of the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade, serving in diplomatic missions in Saudi Arabia, Israel, and Egypt. Yeah. And he was also a Middle East analyst for what was the Office of National Assessments and is now ONI. So let's get into it. So in your book, you talk about the Arab Nizam, which is an Arabic word, loosely translated into the system or the socio-political system of the region. And you say that it's not necessarily individual conflicts or trans or political actors that brought about the 2011 Arab uprisings, but they were only really the most ostentatious representation of this collapse of this Nizam. So can you explain to us more about this concept of the Nizam?
First, let me say it's great to be back at the Lowy Institute. It's always nice to do events here, nice to kind of see people again, where I spent 14 years of my life. And thank you, Lydia. It's always great to talk to you. And certainly when you give as generous an introduction as you do, it's even better to talk with you. So the Nizam. So, you know, as you said, it loosely translates into the system. So when I was writing this book, you've got the challenge of writing what is a very short book. It was meant to be 25,000 words. I think it ended up being 35. But, you know, how do you deal with the great breadth and diversity of the region? And it's really important to do it because, you know, often we do overgeneralize about the Middle East. What struck me and what struck me about the Arab uprisings is it reflected, the fact that it spread across the region reflected some kind of common characteristics that even though each country is unique and diverse, most of the political economies of the region shared. And that was a system of rule that emerged after independence in most countries, despite the fact that some were republics, some were monarchies, some ostensibly followed a socialist system, some ostensibly followed a more kind of capitalist style economy. Basically, the form of rule was the same. It was top-down, so in terms of development, political rule, it was very much a top-down system, obviously in every case authoritarian. Rule was based on very much around a socio-economic contract. In other words, the regimes relied on the provision of social and economic goods to their people, and sometimes, you know, aspirational ideologies or Arab nationalism, for example, that tied the people to the ruler. And so in return for those socioeconomic goods, that national ethos, people gave their loyalty. And then in addition, because authoritarian states are always ruled by a combination of co-option but also obviously coercion, for those people that weren't prepared to accept the socioeconomic contract, the regimes had coercive powers to use. So it's that kind of balance between coercion and co-option. And basically, every state in the region operated in that way. Now, what happened was that kind of form of rule was, you know, in the early years after independence, it was sustainable because it was easy to fund the socioeconomic contract. If you're an oil state, you had, you know, generous oil rents to use. Even if you were a non-oil state, you know, many of these states nationalized industries early on, but also populations were smaller, expectations were lower. You could dramatically, for example, increase access to education and healthcare because it didn't really exist. So in the early years, it was relatively easy to build this social contract and to sustain it. And then when you hit the kind of the 1980s, when it started to become a bit more difficult to sustain that social contract, then you had the influx of oil money. So for the oil economies, suddenly their exploitation of those resources made them fabulously wealthy. But even for countries that didn't have those oil resources, often they were sending their people to work in the oil economies. So through remittances, you were able to sustain that socioeconomic contract. But really then when it hits the 90s, things start to fray. And this is my main point in the book, that when the Arab uprisings happened, everyone was looking for immediate causes. And my point was you had to go back further than that. And what it reflected in my view fundamentally was the crumbling of the Nizam, this old system of rule that had been established after independence. And it's a crumbling that was reflected in the Arab uprisings, and most importantly, it is a crumbling and a decay that has continued to this day. Mm-hmm.
So so all of that makes sense, but then, you know, after the Arab uprisings happened, after there was a lot of initial optimism, for example, you started to see them being viewed as failures because while the system may be collapsing, they didn't manage to tear the whole building down. Yep. So they kind of cut the heads off, but they left the snake alive. So you had Mubarak fall, our Libyan leader, Gaddafi. Thank you. Yes, pictured in my head with his robes. You know, Gaddafi, a lot of other, Ben Ali, they're all fell, but the systems kind of still are decaying, but more or less remained intact. And then many of the people thought, well, that's just a failure of that, actually the systems aren't decaying. Yep. This is, they're actually so much reinforced, more than we even know. But again, you argue the opposite. You say, no, in fact, that this process is still ongoing. And on top of that, there are some new trends that are bubbling up. You call them green shoots in your book that are going to accelerate that and grow. Yep. So can you explain a bit some of those green shoots that you talk about?
Sure. So when a big edifice, and most of these systems of rule were big edifices, it wasn't just, you know, you had very large bureaucracies, you had large security sectors, you had this dynamic of state-led development, you had to the extent there were private sectors in these regimes, they tended to be cronies around, you know, built around, not every case, but kind of a crony economic systems built around regimes. That's a big edifice. That starts to crumble. It can happen dramatically over a few years, then it can slow down. It's got some powers of resilience simply because the people who inhabit that edifice have, you know, are clinging to it because their fortunes and in some cases their lives rely on it. So they have great capacity to slow but not stop that crumbling. And equally, the people who, as a result of this crumbling, as a result of the big cracks that opened up, kind of seize the opportunity to overthrow rulers, you know, they are, it's, you know, it's one thing to come up through a crack, it's another thing to sweep the whole edifice away, and particularly for what were typically political movements led by young people with not a lot of experience, with a lot of naivety about how they approached this process. It's unsurprising that basically the only uprising that has continued really to succeed has been in the Tunisian case, and everywhere else it's been a setback. Now, also, the other problem you have, and it's an interesting question, is the obviously after every revolution anywhere, things get a bit chaotic and disordered, and you get a lot of insecurity. And what happened after uprisings in most cases, and particularly then with the example of Yemen and Syria, which was seen around the region, people got scared that, okay, we didn't like the old order, but at least it provided security and stability, and now that's gone. So at the same time, even though superficial analysis says, okay, the Arab uprisings failed, and there's this tendency to say, okay, we're just going back to the old normal, I think that's wrong, because A, none of the problems that created the Arab uprisings in the first place have been solved. In many cases, the problems have only got deeper. And the cracks in the old order still exist, and it's through those cracks that the green shoots are growing. And by green shoots, I mean a whole range of things whereby, you know, when an existing order, you don't just see this in the Middle East, you see this elsewhere, when an existing order falls apart, the kind of the green shoots of the new order start to emerge. It's not like one day the old order is gone, the next day there's the new order is in its place. You have a period of transition where the kind of the first signs of the new order are starting to emerge. Now, not all of those signs are necessarily positive ones. There will be some negative ones. But what I wanted to focus on the book, because everything you read about the Middle East is negative. And frankly, it's also my own inclination, tend to be my own worldview. So it was something novel for myself to write something kind of reasonably positive. The inclination is to look at all the bad stuff. My point in the book was, yes, all that bad stuff is there, but that's not the whole picture. There are also some really very nascent positive things that are happening that have been allowed to at least sprout because the old system is not as dominant as it used to be. So it was things like new forms of civic political movements, some of whom, you know, were responsible for overthrowing regimes. It was new forms of media that were kind of challenging the dominant state-controlled media. It was in particular the role of women and the way that was changing in society. It was new forms of economic activity. And it was also even new attitudes towards the role of religion in politics. Now, my point with all of these was I'm not guaranteeing that these are all going to kind of grow into a verdant kind of garden that will mean that that tomorrow's Middle East will be much better than today's, but they're there, and there's a chance for them to survive and mature into something more positive.
So, picking that up, which one of those things, in your estimation, which one of these green shoots have the most potential?
I think absolutely the changing role of women. So this is a kind of difficult one to get across. It's not like in 2011 women in the Middle East suddenly became politically active. There is a long history of political activism by women, both on women's issues but also on broader political issues, that goes back decades. But what was transformative about the Arab uprisings was, and you got this sense when you spoke to kind of women activists, was that not just it wasn't just that the old political order was potentially being swept away, but a lot of the social and cultural rules were being re-examined. That it was basically a kind of a fresh start for these societies. And in these societies, for decades, women were becoming better educated, more active. Changing social and cultural norms meant that they were, you know, not completely, but becoming a little less tied to raising families and the home. And what was really interesting about the Arab uprisings was women played a prominent role in almost every uprising, but they didn't play that role as women. It wasn't, I'm here because I want more rights for women. They simply were, they played the role as leading political activists who happened to be women. Now, the other element to this, and the one that doesn't get enough attention, is the economic dimension. If there is one great untapped resource in the Middle East today, it is not oil, it is not some new kind of underground mineral, it is women. Simply because that in most societies, female participation in the workforce has always been has been limited. And why I say this is the thing that has most potential to be most transformative in the shortest amount of time is that in a lot of these societies, women are ready to enter the workforce. So, for example, women have been outpacing men in higher education, in university education, for decades. You know, and you'd see it. I'd go and give a lecture at Cairo University, and 2/3 of the master's class would be women. So there is this great untapped economic potential that could suddenly deliver an economic boost. And the interesting thing is that some of the regimes kind of got it, even if they haven't really grasped it. So, you know, there's been a lot of attention about the Saudi decision to allow women to drive. And what was behind it? Was it just, you know, an effort by the Saudi regime to renovate their, you know, external image to seem less of a kind of conservative society? And I think there were certainly elements of that. But I also think one of the reasons they did it was because they realised if they are going to remake the Saudi economy, if they're going to make it more productive, you have to bring women into the workforce. And you can't bring women into the workforce if they can't drive. Because it becomes, you know, otherwise the only way women are able to drive is if a family member is driving them or if a taxi is driving them. And that's fine for the elite level women, but for everyday women, it becomes a bit like the kind of the cost of childcare, where you're basically, you know, money's coming in one way and going out the other way because you're spending. So that was, in my view, fundamentally an economic reform. Now, for other reasons we can talk about later, it hasn't played that way, or it hasn't been fully grasped by the Saudi regime. Mm. There was an interesting statistic that I kind of came across in writing the book. It was something the IMF did, and they said that in the first decade of this century, if the gap in male female labour participation had been simply twice the global average rather than three times the global average, it would have doubled GDP growth in the region.
Wow.
So it gives you some sense that there is this kind of enormous latent, not just economic but also human potential in the region that is not. That one is not being tapped into, and two, can produce, if it is tapped into, is going to produce the gains very quickly rather than just, you know, over a period of time.
Right. It makes me think, too, you know, there was a lot of talk about young people in general having difficulty finding jobs and an unrealized potential with the youth, which drove a lot of these protests, but also difficulties in getting enough money to get married. And I wonder if that negative trend helped bolster up the more positive trend of greater female independence and participation. It's kind of an interesting thing to.
So it's actually I touch on it in the book, and it plays both ways, right? So, you know, in the Middle East, you know, marriage is generally not a kind of straightforward equation. It usually comes with kind of certain kind of practices and customs. You know, typically you know, young people don't get married until they have the money to move out of the home.
The apartment, the shepka, all that stuff.
All that kind of stuff. Mm. So what that means is, and there are statistics that support this, is that over the last 10, 20 years, men and women have been getting married later. Mm. And what, in a Middle Eastern context, what that means is, because they're getting married later and because they're not assuming the family responsibilities as early as their previous generations were, they've got more time on their hands. Mm. So the question is, what do you do with that time? Now, some of that time was diverted to, you know, efforts around promoting political reform, protesting, kind of, you'd argue, a positive kind of things, working for civil and social and political change. Mm. Of course, some of that free time has also ended up potentially in negative things. So young men going off to join Islamic State. So it does kind of play both ways. But it's an interesting dimension that I think is also still kind of underexplored. What does it mean that people are getting married, you know, at 26 or 27 rather than at kind of 20 or 21?
Right, yeah. So you also mentioned Saudi too. And, you know, that leads me to a question about this idea of reform, not from the grassroots, as you describe in the book, but from the top down.
Yep.
So you've had a lot of leaders, particularly MBS in Saudi Arabia, who's argued about, I am the best reformer for the country, not these grassroots activists. And in fact, the reformists have kind of run up against that wall. So while he might have changed laws regarding women driving, he's jailed all of the activists who pushed for it. So is there a risk that a lot of these green shoots don't blossom because of this new authoritarian in the region that's presenting itself as reformist, but is still quite, you know, limited and coercive in many ways?
Unquestionably, in the short term, there is a real risk to these green shoots from reinvigorated authoritarian regimes who, because they feel threatened by the Arab uprisings, are not just returning to kind of old or reviving old authoritarian practices, they're introducing new ones, you know, using technology to become more authoritarian. So yes, there is definitely a risk to those green shoots. But I would argue there's some of these efforts are also, from a regime's perspective, self-defeating. I think there is a bigger risk to them. So there are a couple of things we need to kind of separate here. One is this kind of notion of top-down reform. And if you look at the Middle East, historically, a lot of big reform in countries and societies has been top-down. You think of, you know, the classic model in Turkey of Ataturk, who in a relatively short period of time transformed Turkey economically, culturally, in education terms, very much top-down. And he did it with an iron fist. So he was no Democrat. Even Nasser in Egypt to a certain degree. The problem is that to do that now, one, you can say, is it possible to kind of mobilize people in the same way when you don't have the access, the control over information that existed, you know, in the first part of the 20th century? And that's definitely not the case. So it's not simply, you can't simply kind of feed people the kind of a worldview anymore. Despite the best efforts of most regimes to shut down independent media, to close the internet, people still get information from the outside. So there is a question in my mind as to whether a regime can actually take its people with it down a reformist path just by pursuing top down. Now, it's true that the kind of development process in the Middle East has just basically been a state-led process, and there's a good argument for continuing to be a state-led process. But my argument is, if you get rid of the people in this equation, which is essentially what Mohammed bin Salman has tried to do in Saudi, which is, we'll let women drive, but we won't recognise the role of women activists. Instead of embracing them, I think you're much more likely to produce a deeper and much more transformative reform if you're embracing the people that are a natural constituency for you, rather than sticking to this old concept of, I don't want anyone else to have any control of this. I want to dictate the pace of it myself, which is fundamentally an insecure posture. You've basically got to take some risks. And in the case of Saudi, it's not a huge risk. It's not like these Saudi women were saying, you know, we want democracy tomorrow, or we want a fundamental transformation. Mm-hmm. You could have easily embraced them, celebrated them, and gone a lot further down the reform path than you have. The other risk for regimes is if you're going to maintain this top-down approach in a period where the regime and the order is crumbling, you are going to have to rely a lot more on coercion. And the big fallacy that I think too many of us cling to is that authoritarian regimes just run by coercion. It's actually not true. Most authoritarian regimes run mainly through co-option and use coercion just in those cases, in the minority of cases, where you really have to. The reason you do that is coercion is expensive. It's a lot of money to maintain those kind of structures. It's also expensive in terms of political capital. Every time you take strongly coercive measures, there is always a reaction. So the problem now is they become more coercive in this expectation that they can keep the lid on the pot. And I just do not think, A, that's realistic, and B, it's simply not supported by even a cursory reading of the Middle East's modern history. Every time regimes have cracked down too hard, there is always a reaction.
That's a great segue to my next question and my last one before I open it up to the audience, which is about these coercive arms of the state. So there is this idea that the autocrat, the person on top, actually controls all of them and is able to deploy them at his whim. But what we see with a lot of these Middle Eastern countries is that there are many security services. They're often in competition with one another, and they have their own interests and constituencies, and the autocrat or the person on top has to manage all of that. So I guess my question is how do these security services that the autocrats rely on for coercive means can threaten the leaders of these countries? And here I'm thinking about the current situation in Sudan. How can reformists within the region exploit those tensions? How can they work with the multitude of these security services to kind of figure out a path forward for reform?
Yeah, it's a great question, and it's a really important point. So in most cases, in every single case, one of the first things that the new rulers of independent regimes in the Middle East did was to set up multiple security services. So one of the things you'll notice, so it's not just army, but internal security services. So you'll notice, for example, that in addition to the army, most authoritarian rulers have some kind of Praetorian Guard, whether it's the Republican Guard or, in the case of Saudi Arabia, the National Guard, basically a military force they can rely on if the mainstream military turn on them. And that similarly operated with internal security services. There were usually more than one, and you wanted more than one basically to balance each other out. So, because the one thing authoritarian rulers know, and because most of them come to power in coups, is the thing you've got to really protect yourself against are coups. Now, it's also something that was a bit lost sight of in the Arab uprisings. The Arab uprisings were the result, in every single case where they succeeded, they were the result of two processes. First was people come out in the streets. The regime's going, oh crap, how do we deal with this? And in the first instance, you send in your internal security services, the police. The army is always your kind of last resort institution, often because the army, wants to defend its kind of apolitical nature, not in every case, but in most. So the second process, the one in which where you see, especially in regimes that were overthrown, is where you send out the police to break up the protests. The police can't do it. The regime calls in the army, and in every single case where the ruler was overthrown, the army said, "No, we're not going to do that." And in those cases where the ruler wasn't overthrown, Syria being the army said, "Sure, we'll do it." Now, the Syrian case, it was because the army was much more part of the regime than it has elsewhere. So even today, where in Egypt, you have the army has effectively taken over running the state. And before the Arab uprising in Egypt, it was very much the interior ministry as the dominant security service. I mean, the army was always there in the background, but it was kind of happy, kind of making money from its kind of involvement in industry and getting the tanks and the aircraft and the toys and being this respected national institution. Now it's kind of switched and the army very much is controlled. But President Sisi is also still trying to manage these various other security services. And in many ways, it's gotten worse because they're all competing either for position with each other, for his kind of love and respect. So some of the abuses of security have come not necessarily as an instruction from Sisi, but because some security services is trying to demonstrate how tough it is. How do opposition movements use this? This is the big question. So it's very clear that other than in Tunisia, in Egypt is a classic case. The young leaders of the uprising either were naive about the role of the army or weren't able to formulate a strategy to ensure that they weren't outplayed by the army. So in Tunisia and in Algeria today, where you've had this next round of uprisings, the big question for the people leading the uprising is how do we deal with the army? Because it could easily go the way of Egypt. Yes, you've gotten rid of the long-term dictator and the army is happy to see the back of them, but that you might be replacing with someone else. Yeah. So, and I'm not sure anyone yet has a really good answer to that question.
Well, I think they're kind of figuring it out on the ground in Sudan right now. You know, the negotiations trying to enact some sort of civilian control.
But they have the benefit of having seen the Egyptian experience and knowing that they can't trust the army, perhaps in the same way that some of the leaders of the Egyptian uprising did in that case.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that's a good time to open it up for questions because, you know, we see with Sudan right now, with Algeria, for a couple of years saying we're never going to see another protest movement again after all of the failures, it shows that there are still demands for systemic change in the region.
Oh, look, and so, you know, today is kind of, it's not quite the 1 year anniversary of the book, but it's around that. I can't remember the exact date we published it. So it would have been terribly embarrassing for me to come up here and say, well, you know, the Nizam has stopped crumbling. So fortunately, I was able to kind of organize the Sudanese and Algerian uprisings to ensure that I could come to you and say, no, see, the crumbling of the system is still continuing.
So you were the hidden hand behind all of
that. Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry. Great. Well, I'm sure people have a lot of questions, so we can open it up if anyone has anything. Otherwise, I'm happy to keep going.
Thank you. So you talked about the Nizam, the social contract, and how that started fraying in the 80s or 90s into the 90s, and also alluded to the fact that the uprisings of the 2011 or thereabouts were often driven by the young people.
Yep.
So what bridge that gap, because the adults of the 80s and 90s weren't driving the revolution,
yep,
how did that come about?
So there are a couple of things that are elements, the kind of pillars of that bridge. One is in the 1990s, the regimes start to understand that the system is crumbling and we have to reform it. And there are two main responses. One is a little bit of kind of political liberalisation, a bit more opening of space to allow people to be more politically active, more independent media. And that actually has a negative kind of consequence for them because it introduces new civil society actors, some of whom eventually, some of the organisations that emerge in the 90s end up playing a role in the in the uprising in 2011, was that opening of that space. But the big reform they undertake is the kind of, you know, some people call it the neoliberal economic reform or liberalisation of the economy. So the idea is, like, the regimes realise the fundamental problem is not, you know, people want more freedom. The fundamental problem is the economy's not working, so we need to reform the economy. And most of them, you know, went through some kind of, you know, IMF-related reform process. The problem was that the nature of the system tended to reduce the benefits of those reforms and exacerbate the negatives. So what do I mean by reduce the benefits? Because the system is not just the authoritarian ruler, but the kind of economic cronies that tend to gather around, as soon as the economy is opening up, the cronies are grabbing the opportunities for themselves. So, for example, in the case of Tunisia, people would say, you know, one of the problems that led to the Tunisian uprising is, you know, the Tunisian economy is run by 10 or 12 families, right? And one of the things it creates is this vast informal economy, and people are vulnerable to all sorts of things when you're working in the informal economy. Something like 50% of the economy is informal. So you've got this kind of reform effort that not only doesn't work, but actually starts to accentuate some of the disparities in society. So I remember this. So I served in Egypt. I was in Egypt actually doing language training in the early 90s. And you started to see this, but it really starts to accelerate in the early 2000s, where some of the benefits of economic liberalization start to flow through into, you know, a place like Egypt, but it flows through very unevenly. So, you know, the top end of town and, you know, the slight broadening of the middle class, some people are enjoying the fruits of this stuff, but there are lots of people that aren't. And what's worse for the regime and regime stability is people can see it, right? So it's billboards going up advertising, you know, Western goods, jeans, and people can see that despite the fact that I went to university, despite the fact that I'm smart, I'm not getting that. So it must be corruption, and that's why corruption, but also dignity, emerges really big themes in the uprising. It's even things like, so in Egypt they had this thing in the early 2000s where they started building these huge housing estates on the outskirts of Cairo that were like this kind of, someone had basically grabbed an American-style housing estate, gated community, picked it up from the Midwest of the US and plopped it in the desert. Like, there was one I remember driving past, and it was even called in English Lakeside, and the shore as hell wasn't any lake there. So people were seeing that as well, this kind of that sense of privilege. And you know, you saw that, for example, in the years that led up to the 2011 uprising, you know, Egypt was talked about as this poster child for IMF reform. Growth rates were high, but people weren't burrowing beneath the numbers. So what comes together in 2011 is younger people who have benefited a bit from the political liberalisation, have become more politically active, combined with, you know, the internet, greater knowledge, social media, greater knowledge of the world and of the freedoms that exist, together with their parents' generation who have seen all this economic reform and hasn't actually delivered them any benefits. So it's that coalescing of those and other groups in the square in 2011. It's the young people that are leading the protests, but look around them and the protesters, a lot of them are older, because that was that sense, again, especially in Egypt, that you know, Egyptians bear a lot in life. You know, they'll say Egypt can be a tough place to live, but there was that sense, particularly in the early 2000s, that just things were just, it was just too hard. It was just too hard to get by in life. And you had a few external shocks that made that worse. So you had the 2008 financial crisis, which drove up food prices. So all those things kind of coalesced, but they were all still fundamentally a reflection of the fact that the system was broken.
The G20 conference is to be held in Riyadh, I think, next year.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just wondering what the long-term effect of that might be on the Saudi people.
So it's a good question, because so a little background. Mohammed bin Salman is leading a reform effort in Saudi Arabia that is fundamentally an economic one. And it reflects partly what I'm talking about, the kind of decay of the old system, but a particular aspect of it. The Saudis understand that in their modern history, their most important single source of income was oil. The Saudis understand that going forward, and you know, they have very smart people working in the oil industry who look forward and think, well, what is the price of oil going to be? And yes, it may have spikes and it'll go down, but generally the trajectory is downward as the world becomes less reliant on oil, needs less oil. And if oil is the thing that fundamentally lubricates your political economy, lubricates your system, longer term, you realize you're in trouble. So therefore, what do you do? You've got to basically transform your political economy. And because they still have wedded to this top-down model, what they're basically trying to do is go, all right, we know that, you know, oil will still be important for many years and it'll still provide us a lot of money, but to kind of really, we need to kind of tap into another source of wealth. And that source, you know, they talk about the private sector, but really what they're talking about is we are going to get our wealth now from being a global investment powerhouse. So this was all the talk about selling parts of Aramco, which so far hasn't come to fruition, create this even bigger sovereign wealth fund, invest, be a global investor, and those returns from those investments will flow back into the Saudi regime and they'll lubricate their political economy that way. Now, the problem with that for them is, well, actually there are lots of problems with that kind of model, but one big problem is as the world gets much more socially conscious about who are investors and reputation becomes more important, it's much tougher to be a global investor if people are asking questions about, well, you know, don't, you know, about your image. And particularly if you're kind of, you know, strangling journalists in your consulate in Istanbul, that presents an image problem. Now, at the moment, it doesn't. It's, you know, there are still multinational companies that are interested enough in Saudi Arabia to kind of, you know, dodge and weave a bit. So after Khashoggi was killed, there was going to be this big investment conference in Riyadh. A lot of companies didn't go. But since then, some of them have flowed back because ultimately the rewards are potentially quite big. But I don't think that's sustainable over the longer term. So because more and more is emerging about what the regime does, you know, there is a real mood in Congress to punish the Saudis over the war in Yemen. Whether that actually comes to any fruition, big question mark. So this is, which brings us back to the G20. The G20 will be a great barometer of how well the Saudis are doing in overcoming some of those rather large image speed bumps they've experienced. There will be a G20 summit there, but the question will be who will attend and at what level. You can expect all the G20 countries to be there, and if it's all the G20 kind of presidents and prime ministers, then you can say the Saudis have gotten over their image problems. But if it's a couple of presidents and prime ministers and lots of finance ministers or kind of lower down, then there's a sense that there's a problem there.
Brian Everingham, Institute of International Affairs. Anthony, I didn't know you were so Pollyanna-ish, but I'd like to ask you. I'd like to ask you specifically of the three non-Arab states that have a huge role in where the Middle East is going. That's Israel, Turkey, and Iran.
Mm-hmm.
Their roles seem to be increasing quite dramatically,
yep,
and influencing much more than just the edges, but within those Arab states as well.
So when I wrote the book, it was not just about the Arab Middle East; it was about the Middle East as a whole. Turkey plays a bit more of a peripheral role in the book, although it gets a mention. Israel more peripherally. Iran gets more of a mention. They are, in their own ways, also part of this same process, with some important differences, particularly in the case of Turkey and Israel. Let me take Iran first. So one of the things I say in the book is, for me, a lot of, you know, it's not just within. It's not just that the system within states is crumbling, but the order between states in the region has also been crumbling, driven by a whole range of factors, principally, really, by the changing US role in the region. And the invasion of Iraq was one element in that, although it wasn't the only element. And basically, this idea, well, basically, the US is on a trajectory where its influence in the region is diminishing, sometimes as a result of its actions and sometimes as a result of its own choice, right? And you saw that, you know, for me, there's a continuity between Obama and Trump, and that is this kind of tiredness with the region and wanting to extract yourself as you can. And it's kind of, you know, it's uneven, it's not linear, but it's there. So as the old order crumbles, a new order is starting to emerge, and so the big players in the region and sometimes some of the smaller ones are jostling for position and power, and that's one of the drivers of instability in the region at the moment. So Iran, for example, has seen the opportunities to exploit both the internal weaknesses in many states but also the kind of, you know, growing US kind of tiredness with the region. Some external actors exploited as well, most notably the Russians. But I think the most interesting thing is not, you know, there's a big focus today on the rivalry between, you know, Iran and Israel and the Sunni Arab states, in particular Saudi Arabia. For me, people are focusing on the wrong thing, as is often the case in the Middle East. For me, the most interesting rivalry between Iran and Saudi Arabia is not the war for you know, not the proxy wars they're fighting, but it's the race to reform their domestic political economies. Because the thing that will determine who is the most influential country in the region will not be who wins the war in Yemen. It'll be which country in 10 or 15 years is not crumbling internally and has modernized their economy. And you can have a really interesting debate about whether the Saudis or the Iranians are ahead in that race in the moment. Both of them have their own kind of challenges. And honestly, I wouldn't give a view at the moment because it's a kind of a half a dozen, you know. There are cases on both sides. So for me, that's the main challenge the Iranians face. Turkey, in many ways, is similar, right? So it's no coincidence that as the Turkish economy started to look more shaky, as Erdogan has started to behave in a more authoritarian manner, that his kind of new Ottomanism, the kind of the greater role in the Middle East has increased, and I think partly to distract people from what's happening at home. And so I think the same thing applies to Turkey. Ultimately, you know, Turkey's influence in the region is not going to be determined by, you know, the proxy wars it fights in Syria or elsewhere. It's going to be about whether Erdogan is able to revive the economy and what kind of an authoritarian ruler he's turning into. And you've already seen where in the last election you started to see his failure economically starting to flow through into electoral results. Israel Israel's always a little bit kind of sui generis, but, you know, very interesting kind of situation where economically they're still doing very well. The problem is it's more of a kind of a social and a political problem. Some of those authoritarian tendencies that you see, you know, not to the same extent, obviously, in Saudi Arabia and Iran, but some of those authoritarian tendencies that you see, say, in Western democracies, the kind of tendency to point to fake news, to try and shut down the independence of the media, the kind of the polarized debates, you are very much playing out in Israel today. So the decision overnight for the Knesset to dissolve itself and go to the elections again is going to be very, very interesting to watch. And that will play a massive role because Bibi Netanyahu has been a key driver in a lot of those processes. And if he is removed either electorally or legally, then it'd be interesting to see how that plays out.
I think we have time just for one more question. My last question to you, Anthony, I have many more, but I'll ask this last one, is about something you pointed to about these authoritarian tendencies that we're starting to see in the West as well. And it makes me think that, you know, prior to the Bush years of the, you know, the freedom years, and you know, there was a big push for human rights and reform 10 years ago. Now it seems that some of these reformers in the Middle East are on their own, that you don't see the same support coming out of Europe, the United States, Australia, and instead more established democracies are starting to pick up some of these authoritarian tendencies. And I can't tell you how many times I've taken a look at what's happening electorally either in Europe or the United States and reminding me of something that has been going on in the Middle East for a long time, whether it's disinformation or interference and that kind of thing. Yeah. So do you think that is a great hindrance, or do you think it's good that, you know, the region's going to be well alone?
It's a really great question, and one I struggled with in writing the book. So in the end, the decision I came to was I did not want this book to be about the West's role in the Middle East, and I certainly did not want it to be about how the West should remake the Middle East. But you cannot write a book about the Middle East without talking about the West. So I dealt with it in two ways. One was simply to say, you know, acknowledging that the West plays in its actions sometimes, you know, both sometimes beneficial to the region, but also in negative ways, clearly plays in the role in the region. But this book, which is only a small book, is actually about what the people of the region are doing themselves. It's not about the West's role in the region. So that's one way to deal with it. Another way to deal with it is to write a little postscript chapter which talks about the role of the West. And that's where I deal with this question of What role should the West play in all this? And it's something that I always kind of think about, return to, and you know, when I think about, you know, 25 years looking at the Middle East, have gone through different kind of attitudes towards it. And where I kind of come out in the book is basically to say, the first thing is we have to allow the people of the region to remake their own region. So, and even when we have good intentions, as we've seen throughout the region's history and including modern history, often our good intentions have really negative consequences. Secondly, that at the same time, it would be naive to deny that our actions don't have consequences for the region. So what I think our focus should be is not coming up with grandiose schemes to democratize the region or to even to remake regional economies. What we should be focusing on is protecting those positive forces, those green shoots in the region, and allowing them the opportunity to grow, thrive, and evolve. And that means, that's the third point, which is, you know, you can debate about what active role the West should play in the Middle East's transformation, but we should definitely not play a passive role, which is to support authoritarian regimes in the region in every action. Now, I'm a former foreign policy professional. I'm realistic enough to know that for very good reasons of national interests, we will have to deal with these regimes on questions that are important to our safety, our security, and our prosperity. But at the same time, you can go too far. You can provide too much cover for these regimes and the actions they take. It's important that we call out, even if we don't think it's going to be effective, it's important to call out the abuses, to provide what protection you can for positive forces in the region to emerge. It is, for example, in my mind, crazy that we are still selling the amount of arms we are to the region. You know, the region is on fire. What it doesn't need is someone throwing hand grenades into the fire, right? What does that do? It just makes the fire bigger. So that's a kind of, you know, that's a no-brainer from my perspective. And, you know, again, you know, you selectively, not in every situation. But it also means that, and there's a sense that we are falling back into old practices. So, you know, years ago in the debate in the kind of policy and economic community about Islamist actors and whether they're democratic or not democratic, there was a former US State Department official who came up with this famous line that you have to be very suspicious of Islamist actors even when they're kind of peaceful, because they're not really interested in democracy. They're interested in one man, one vote, one time. And this became this kind of catchphrase that was used in every single debate. For me, the truth of it is our reliance on, or the West's reliance on authoritarian dictators has been driven by this desire for one man, one phone call, one time. One point of contact with the regime. When we have a problem, you call up one person, fix this, and that's it. And that is, for me, it's both unwise, but also not sustainable. Because I don't think, for the reasons I've outlined today, the kind of the crumbling nature of this system, that the authoritarian regimes, even the re-amped authoritarianism we see around the region today, ultimately is likely to prove resilient. Mm.
Well, Anthony, as always, I always learn so much talking to you. So please join me in thanking Anthony Lubuda. Come back. Thank you again, everyone.